from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush is on his way to Bali in Indonesia tonight, the latest stop on a whirlwind tour of Asia since World War II. The United States has been the preeminent power in Asia, and the business of Asia has been, ultimately, business. But this time out, the American president's agenda is all about security, terrorism, and weapons, just as booming China mounts a charm offensive as everyone's best business buddy. Washington is being heard, but so is Beijing. Tonight on Point, President Bush in Asia and the changing role of the United States there as China steps up. Can the U.S. be all about security and terror and still be appealing in Asia? Is the smiling face of China the new face of leadership on the other side of the Pacific? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York City is Elizabeth Economy, Senior Fellow for China and Director of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's also an Adjunct Professor of Political Science at Columbia University and author of The River Runs Black, The Environmental Challenge to China's Future. Good evening and welcome, Elizabeth Economy.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks so much for joining us. So lots of Asian leaders gathered today in Bangkok, 21, President Bush included, and they have stepped up to a new kind of sense of themselves around issues of security. Can you describe that to us, Elizabeth Economy?
Well, I think President Bush has really set the agenda for APEC this time around, as he has since 2001 in the wake of September 11th.
This is the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation.
Exactly.
Forum.
And he's right. And he's moved very quickly through Asia. As you pointed out, he's going to be visiting in total six countries in the space of 6 days with his meetings in Indonesia and Australia thus to go. Thus far, I think he's found it fairly tough sledding. But his greatest success was on the security front, where APEC leaders, by and large, I think, were receptive to his efforts to get them to work more closely to combat terrorism.
So do we have a new Asian version of NATO emerging here, or what exactly is going on?
No, we don't have anything close to something resembling an Asian version of NATO. At most, we have a very loose alliance between President Bush and the leaders of the APEC countries to begin to work together to combat terrorism. In many respects, we still have very limited military-to-military cooperation with some of these countries. We're just in the nascent stages of training some of their police forces. This is all about beginning to put together a construct to help these countries combat terrorism.
Elizabeth Economy, is President Bush's new and sharp focus on security and terrorism welcome in Asia? The language that we're used to hearing out of these conferences is all about trade and industry and business. Here comes George Bush, and it's all about weapons nonproliferation and stopping terrorism and security. Is this welcome?
Well, I think a few things have combined to make the message more welcome than it might otherwise be. I think that the bombing in Bali, for example, I think the threat of a nuclear North Korea, both of these things have made the region more receptive to President Bush's sort of taking over the agenda for security. Nonetheless, there's been a good deal of grumbling about the transformation of the agenda and about the fact that the United States has sort of moved this away from a strictly economic focus and sort of made it its own agenda.
And you've written about this grumbling, Elizabeth, economy grumbling, whatever, coming at the same time that China is on a big charm offensive when it's no longer been anything like in retreat. It's been out there. It's been forging bigger and bigger business ties with Asian nations and making nice with everybody. So what does that mean for the relative, I don't know, throwaway, to use a bad term, of China and the United States in Asia today? Is China taking the lead or moving into a partnership or a peer position with the U.S. because it is all about business?
Right. I think China has won a lot of points over the past few years simply by listening and by engaging, by trying to take into account the concerns and the interests of its Asian partners in a manner that the Bush administration really hasn't even attempted to do. We have been very much about a unilateral approach. And in contrast, China has been all about engagement, and it's begun to provide a lot of development assistance to the region. It's been pushing for its regional free trade agreements, signing on to security accords that it previously had been reluctant to sign on to, stepping up to the plate with North Korean negotiations, and now, oddly enough, being roped into a partnership to talk about the roadmap to democracy for Myanmar. I mean, here we have an authoritarian regime that certainly doesn't practice democracy, has its own human rights abuses, and yet is being treated as an equal partner with the U.S. to talk about moving Myanmar toward democracy. So there's no doubt about the fact that China has made tremendous inroads in the region. Still, I would caution against saying that it's ready to assume the mantle of leadership from the United States. It's really a long way from doing that, either as a military force within the region or even as an economic force within the region, where Japan is still the big player in terms of the economics of the region, in terms of development assistance. So,
but let's look at some of the numbers there for just a moment, if we could, Elizabeth Economy. Last year, for the first time, we read Japan's imports from China surpassed those from the United States. Japanese exports to China surged 39% in 1 year. That is an enormous gain. China is now South Korea's largest trading partner, and they've got to push on to do something like $100 billion of business with Southeast Asian nations within the next couple of years, which would bring them almost to the same level of trade as the United States. Is China buying its way into co-equal status with the U.S.?
Right. I mean, I think that there is certainly an element of that. Nonetheless, its development assistance, for example, is lags much far behind that of the United States or of Japan, maybe a third that of the United States. You know, it's really very far away. But you're absolutely right. China's been on a tremendous capital development program, and that has meant the purchase of a lot of raw materials from Southeast Asia. It's a big purchaser of electronics goods from Southeast Asia. So, yes, I think, for the time being, China has been making a lot of progress in terms of its trade with the region. But there's also the issue of whether this can continue. And the Chinese leadership has been very bullish in terms of its prognosis for the future of the Chinese economy. But the Chinese economy has some structural weaknesses that may mean that it slows down a bit. And when it slows down a bit, then all of this buying will slow down a bit, too.
And maybe with that, some of the super popularity they've been gaining recently.
Exactly.
Elizabeth Economy, stand by in New York. I want to welcome into our conversation with me in the studio Robert Ross. He's just walked in through the door. He's professor of political science at Boston College, author of Engaging China, The Management of an Emerging Power, and a Reexamination of Cold War Conflict and Cooperation. Good evening and welcome, Robert Ross.
Good evening. Hello, Liz.
Hi, Bob.
So you're with us, Robert Ross, looking out on this picture of President Bush zooming around Asia. Six nations, 8 days. His visit to Indonesia, all of 3 hours, and that on Hindu Bali, not on the Muslim main islands. But what do you make of the president bringing his big agenda of security, terror, weapons nonproliferation into a region where China is all about these booming trade figures? Does it make the United States look like some kind of gloom and doom fearmonger out there, or is this a welcome face right now? There is terror there.
Let me first pick up on those numbers you were just citing. I think they're very important.
So the increase in Chinese trade with its neighbors.
That's right. Overall, Chinese trade this year may grow approximately 9%. But if you just look at that coastal region, let's say 300 million, that 300 million makes it already the second largest market in the world.
You're talking about China's coast there and 300 million Chinese living on the coast.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That part of the population growing approximately 15 to 20% per year. So that is the second largest market.
The economy is growing that fast,
right,
along that coastal region where its industry and commerce are centered.
Exactly. And if we're lucky, we will do 3%. And so as a magnet on imports, we cannot compete with China. So was three.
Well, the United States remains a huge market for Asian imports.
But as you were pointing out, the trends.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, 3 years ago, the mainland became Taiwan's most important export market. 2 years ago, it became South Korea's most important target of investment. And last year, it became South Korea's most important export market. And when you think of political power, one gets power from markets. because other economies depend upon you for employment and economic growth.
Mm-hmm. So if you're a big, attractive market, you've got clout.
And so that market is growing 15 to 20% per year. We're growing 3% per year if we're lucky. Those trends may go up and down over time. China may encounter problems. But that long-term trend, unless China experiences significant problems, is likely to continue. And so as an economic power, I would say China's already emerging as the, as we say, the engine of growth in East Asia. Now, for example, Japan. If current trends continue, the Japanese market, Japan will depend more on the Chinese market in 3 or 4 years than it does in the United States.
Depend more meaning in absolute terms? It will export more to China than to the USA?
If current trends continue, absolutely. Now, that's a sea shift.
That's astounding, given what a key market the U.S. has been. That is astonishing.
Those are Japanese Ministry of Finance statistics.
Okay, so let's say these are the trend lines.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Economy points out China has some structural problems.
Absolutely.
They could stumble into a manhole here and have all kinds of problems at home. But if that doesn't happen, what does this mean for leadership in the Asian region? The United States has been essentially, in political terms and at some level in economic terms, in terms of policy, unchallenged. For a long time.
Well, I would also suggest that the closer you are to China, the more its military power comes into play. So take the Korean Peninsula, where we see economic trends and military trends coming together simultaneously. And the impact is striking. Perhaps we had the most serious crisis since the Korean War just this year. And in the middle of this crisis,
North Korea pumping up its nuclear program.
Exactly. And the threat of war was very real. And South Korea, rather than align itself with the United States, its foremost ally, chose rather to be closer to China in the midst of this crisis and to work through China to manage the North Korean threat.
So where are we headed here, Robert Ross?
Can I interject on that?
Sure, please.
Bob, I would suggest, though, that it wasn't a function of South Korea choosing to align itself with China. Rather, the South Korean approach to the North Korean challenge, the Chinese approach, the Japanese approach, frankly, everybody's approach, aside from that of the U.S., was basically in sync.
And the U.S. was the odd man out.
Exactly. The U.S. was the odd man out, both in its reluctance to approach the problem bilaterally, in its call for sanctions. It's a much tougher approach.
But nevertheless, Elizabeth Economy, that leaves China and South Korea on the same page, Washington on a different page.
Well, I
think
that's true, although we've seen the countries now, I think, move much closer together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the other countries have come down, and I think rightly so, on the side of the United States in advancing multilateral negotiations. They're now talking about some form of a multilateral security agreement, arrangement, something. It's not clear what it's going to be.
But the choir may sing in unison ultimately. Still, the fact remains, it was the U.S. that was the outrider there, at least for a while. Robert Ross, we want to keep Elizabeth Economy right in this, but finish your thought. Where do you see all this heading?
I think on one hand, we were the odd man out. Indeed, much of the region was quite frightened of our policy. But South Korea had been rejecting American pressure to change its North policy since the beginning of the Bush administration. I think it felt it had both a necessity and an opportunity to work through China.
We'll come back to Korea, but look beyond that theater. Here we've got all these Asian leaders meeting in Bangkok the last few days. The Chinese leader there, who's looking like they're in tune with the region? Can the U.S. maintain its leadership position if it's all focused on security or not?
Well, in November of 2002, China signed this very important free trade agreement with the ASEAN countries. That is mostly Indonesia, Philippines.
Southeast Asia.
That's right. And if you look closely, it very much resembles American policy toward the globe following World War II. China opened its markets to these countries with this agreement and gave them preferential access to its own market, understanding that it will draw them into its economic orbit. The American response has been trying to reach free trade agreements with Singapore, the Philippines, Thailand, and even Taiwan.
Bilateral one-to-one agreements, so what?
So that we can open our markets to these countries and try and offset the Chinese pull. Over the long run, as I suggested, we can't do that. Not when this 300 million people are growing at a rate of 15 to 20% per year. That long-term trend in economics is really out of our control to influence.
Now, Elizabeth Economy, 20 seconds before the break here, but do you agree with that? Is China going to pull ahead of the U.S.
on
economic terms?
I think that much of this is a matter of perception. The reality might be quite different. For example, the Regional Free Trade Agreement hasn't actually been signed and come into force. What we have is a promise to actually move toward one at this point in time. Moreover, it's likely to be what they call some kind of neighboring agreement, which means that the reality of the free trade will be something quite less than, for example, what the United States and Singapore has signed in terms of...
Hey, listen, economy, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Robert Rice, Ross, the same. We're talking tonight about President Bush in Asia and America's changing role there as China steps up. Can the U.S. be all about security and still be appealing in Asia? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Bush in Asia and America's changing role there as China steps up. Washington's pushing security. Beijing is all charm and business. So the question is, does President Bush sound like a prophet of growth and prosperity or a prophet of fear and doom on this quick jaunt through Asia? Are 50 years of American leadership in Asia giving way to the Chinese century? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, joining us from New York, Elizabeth Economy, Senior Fellow for China and Director of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And with me in the studio tonight, Robert Ross, Professor of Political Science at Boston College, author of Engaging China. Elizabeth Economy, let me ask you first, what does it matter who leads, who dominates the conversation in Asia?
Well, I think nothing probably more clearly demonstrates why it matters than 9/11, and the fact that the United States could, you know, walk into Shanghai, where the APEC meeting was being held a month after 9/11, mm-hmm. and say, you know what, we can't talk about trade and investment. We need to talk about terrorism. We've just been attacked, and we want to know who's with us and who's against us.
So a snap of the fingers, and the agenda was changed.
Exactly. And had that happened to any other country, I would suggest that no other country would be able to have walked into the door like that and had the agenda switched like that.
But so what? With or without that, the business goes on behind the APEC agenda. It's not as though there's not a reality that bubbles along, whether or not the U.S. has the baton here.
Well, business continues, of course, but I think as we're trying to rally support from all of these countries, from, you know, critical countries like Indonesia and the Philippines, Singapore, where terrorists are lodged, we need their support. I mean, we need to be able to rally these countries behind what, in essence, was an entirely U.S. Dominated agenda. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, no other country shared our fear of terrorism.
So on this visit to APEC, you said that President Bush faced in part some rough sledding. Where was the sledding rough, and where did he get what he wanted?
Well, I think that the sledding was, I think that where he came out ahead was clearly on the security agenda. He didn't get everything he wanted, certainly not with regard to support, you know, troops and money for Iraq, except for Japan, which had already pledged the money in any case, and Australia, which had already pledged troops. But the security, I think, on the security front, it was the most positive. I think in terms of the economy, you know, he was trying to press China again to revalue the UN. I think he got nowhere on that issue. Trying to persuade the Japanese not to intervene in currency markets, I think he got nowhere on that issue. In terms of human rights with Myanmar and their human rights issues and the sort of security of Aung San Suu Kyi, the human rights activist, he also really got nowhere there. So I think on the security issues, North Korea and terrorism, he achieved his greatest success. On the other issues, I don't think he made much progress. I would say, you know, this trip has been, you know, neither a triumph, but not also really a disaster for him.
But Robert Ross, let me put it to you then. North Korea, clearly important, an urgent issue there, could have gone to war, could still go to war if it doesn't go right. But in general, in nodding in the affirmative to the security request of the United States here, but not giving much on the currency issues, the business issues that are most urgent, is Asia kind of shining Washington on and nodding and saying, yes, 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 security, of course, but doing business just the way they have, just the way China is?
Put this in the context of the either gloom or doom and security economics dichotomy. It's important that the Southeast Asian nations, we understand, are content in dealing with China and making money in China and do not feel a Chinese threat. The reason for that is because the American military is so dominant in that part of the world. There is no challenge to the American military. And with that, we provide that security envelope that allows them to enter into China with some degree of security.
Even with all of China's increased spending on the military, even with Chinese taikonauts, astronauts in space?
Absolutely. These Southeast Asian countries we need to understand are far from China, 2,000-3,000 miles away, large bodies of water, without a Chinese Navy that can cross that body of water. For much of the world, the world's oceans remain American lakes. Mm-hmm. So that part of the world, America reigns, and there is no challenge.
Militarily.
And that context enables that peaceful, cooperative economic relationship with China. So when the president goes into the region, he's going in as still a leader of the most important military. Now, he had an uphill battle. Those issues that Liz ticked off were very difficult to make progress on. The fact that he didn't succeed is not indicative of a declining America in the security realm.
The issues of security or issues of the economic? You're talking Japanese currency mm-hmm. controls.
Human rights are always an uphill battle.
Mm-hmm.
Coercing the Japanese economy is difficult. Reevaluating the Chinese yuan are just difficult issues. We're making progress in the security realm. For example, we have greater access today than we did 2 years ago for our aircraft carriers in Singapore. We have greater access to the Philippines in fighting terrorism and troop presence. So in that agenda, which is most important to us, we're making key progress.
So Elizabeth, economy, if things continue to unfold in this way, President Bush gets some of what he wants on the economy, on the security side, China booming along on the economic side. What's the power-sharing arrangement, deliberate or willy-nilly, that you see emerging between the United States and China in Asia?
Well, I think, you know, you've drawn a fairly dramatic dichotomy, I think, between the security and the economy. And I think that probably the boundaries are a little bit more blurred than that. We still are, by far, a dominant power economically in the region, along mm-hmm. with Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Again, China is rising, you are quite correct. But again, it is not where the United States is. And it won't be for probably at least another 5 years if, again, it maintains its rates of economic growth, which is a big if.
Mm-hmm.
On the security front, too.
Still, as we said, Japan's imports from China surpass those in the United States. That's a big deal.
No, you're right. That is a big deal. But by the same token, again, we are the
huge second, economically in spite
exactly.
of
exactly. And I think on the security front, absolutely Bob is right. We provide the security umbrella for the entire region, not just for Southeast Asia, but for East Asia, too, China excepted. But I think here, too, you see China beginning to make some inroads in terms of the role that it's playing, for example, in the, brokering the agreements, hopefully, on North Korea.
Is this a sustainable relationship, though? China has Washington, has the United States in its backyard with all this military and economic clout. As it picks up steam, and again, it could fall in a hole, but may not, as it picks up steam in its own sense of power and place, is it willing to share this stage with Washington? Can they share it comfortably? What's the evidence so far?
Well, I would suggest that the trend is a positive one right now. I think relations between the United States and China today are as good as they've been since 1989, since Tiananmen, one of the great surprises of the Bush administration, frankly speaking,
mm-hmm.
Given where they started. So right now, I think you could say that we've found a way of working together on a number of important issues. But if you look at, especially in the security front, but I think if you look at the trade issue between the United States and China, if you look at the human rights issue, if you look at the potential for Taiwan to sort of rear its ugly head yet again, then there are some very key points of conflict. I don't think the sort of battle for the hearts and minds of Southeast Asia is one of those issues that's likely to trigger a real conflict in the relationship. I think these other issues are probably more important in terms of the bilateral relationship.
We're talking about President Bush in Asia. You can join the conversation. Can you feel China's momentum? If you were Thailand, Indonesia, who looks hotter, China or the USA? Who's got the buzz in Asia? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I don't think it's a matter of buzz, and I don't even think it's trendy. I think we're seeing things fall back into cultural lines. And in this particular case, I think we're talking about a Confucian culture. Japan may actually be the first one to bow to the power. we're talking about cultures that are accustomed to a hierarchy form of power as opposed to a hegemonic power, which really wasn't introduced to them until, what, the late 19th century.
So you're saying the Middle Kingdom, China, is making a comeback. It feels natural and familiar to everybody. Does it still, after all these years of American presence there and all the history that's gone down?
Well, the issue that you had, and your one guest made the point that, you know, it's important that we go in there and snap our fingers and say, you know, the war on terrorism. No one wants to bow to that anymore, and I don't think Asia wants to play the step and fetch it role to the United States. I think they're looking for a cultural equivalent, certainly in their region, and we may even see Australia fall under that dominance just because they are in the area.
So what do you think that means for the United States, David, that China takes the throne there and the U.S. is suddenly looks like the outsider with all of the economic connections that the United States has to Asia?
We're not an outsider. We're just going to be forced to replay our hand back in our own sphere of influence. I think our star's on the descent.
Interesting. David, thanks for your call. Robert Ross, how about it? There is a lot of history here. China wasn't called the Middle Kingdom for nothing. They may have named themselves, but still, they put themselves at the center. Is that reemerging in some degree? Is there a cultural element here?
A couple of points there. Those who will exaggerate the Chinese expansionist drive will indeed point to this Middle Kingdom mentality. It's important to underscore that the countries of Southeast Asia were never part of China's traditional Middle Kingdom. They were not Confucian. They were a variety of different religions and sects. But the Chinese world order was primarily Korea, Taiwan, Vietnam, and that was about it, with intermittent other countries falling in and out. So in that respect, China's already reached that limit, with the exception of the Korean Peninsula and Taiwan. The second point is that for China to erase our role in the region or to minimize our role, it's going to have to find a way to reach us out there in that water.
To reach us, to build a navy, in other
build
words.
Build a navy. That's a long way off. And so I think, as you were saying, sharing leadership, what's emerging is that America will reign that maritime part of Asia, but we will work together with China in that mainland area where its reach will grow, and we will both have to have a role to play.
So for the first time, the U.S. then has not an equal, but because Japan always played such a second fiddle role, despite its economic power, some kind of peer. What does that relationship look like in Asia as these two settle into the cockpit, Robert Ross?
It's important to underscore that we did leave Indochina in 1975. And that didn't bother us. We never felt less secure. So that Chinese role of growth on the mainland is something we're prepared to live with. And so that's not a real problem. The Korean Peninsula, of course, poses far graver consequences because we have a 50-year commitment. But in some respects, we're returning to a full circle. In 1950, Secretary of State Dean Acheson basically said, what's important to the United States and East Asia is Japan and the Philippines. Now, we established commitments to Korean Peninsula and Taiwan because of a war there, which we said we had to stop aggression, not because those pieces of territory were intrinsically important. With peaceful change, which is what we're witnessing, we can begin to evolve a different kind of leadership and a different kind of order in East Asia.
Elizabeth, the economy is fascinating because as China grows, the global relationship with the U.S. and the power balance there becomes a fascinating relationship. So here we have the first venue to really watch it unfold. Do you see a division of powers or areas of interest emerging between Washington and Beijing within the region? What does the world look like in Asia when you have two powers there, even without a Chinese navy?
I don't really see a clear-cut division at this point in time. Again, I see China as very much sort of still up and coming. I mean, Bob points out the enormous discrepancy in terms of the military strength in the region. I think at the same time, China's steps thus far are really their baby steps in terms of its diplomacy. They're important baby steps, but they're nonetheless baby steps. You know, there is the potential for conflict in the South China Sea with a number of these nations. Now, China has signed on to a new security accord to talk about joint development. That's a very...
Of oil fields there.
Potentially some oil, right, and other marine resources, but right, potentially oil. But this is a very first step. There's conflicts on the Mekong River in terms of development of the Mekong River and China's dams. There are a lot of areas that we haven't touched on where the region is still concerned about Chinese behavior. I think what we can say is that China has made significant strides, again, in trying to assuage the fears of its neighbors. But I don't buy the argument that they are looking to China to replace the United States at this point in time, particularly if we're talking about countries like Japan, Australia, the Philippines, Singapore, I mean, frankly, any of these countries at this point in time. China is still an authoritarian state, represses its people in certain ways. Granted, it's made enormous strides over the past several decades in this regard, but I don't think that any of these countries are looking to China to lead them at this point.
Fred's calling from Lakewood, Wisconsin. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. A few minutes ago, you spun me up. There was a comment made about the American military presence in the area being the thing that stabilizes the markets, or words to that effect anyway. And so that got me to call because I have the concern that we believe somehow that the underlying stability anywhere in the world, or the stability anywhere in the world, is maintained by the presence of American military strength, even market stability.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the chauvinistic view that Americans have about their military and their power is flawed. I think the market stability that we can find in the world, and I have an example that I'll mention in a second, that the market stability that we can find in the world will arise out of our fairness with respect to markets, not out of our ability to invade
to
or
put the guns in. Fred, give us your example real quick. Our time's running short in this segment.
Yeah, a few weeks ago, at one of the World Conference summits, the United States disagreed with everybody else and went on to continue subsidies of American cotton. That means the Mali peasants in Africa, people practically have to eat dirt to stay alive, can hardly sell their own cotton in their own country.
So you're saying build a base of stability on mutually beneficial economic relationships and not on the back of guns. Fred, our time's short, but thanks very much for your call. Elizabeth Economy, you write about Washington in discussions to develop new U.S. military bases in Australia, in Malaysia, in, kind of incredibly, Vietnam. Does it look to Asia as though that is the lead foot of Washington all the time, military, or is that an exaggeration in your view?
I don't know that Washington looks to Asia as the lead foot, as you put it, but I do think that as it is so concerned about the war on terror at this point in time, that starting to think through bases throughout this region, yes, becomes critically important.
And does that make Asia a good market, a more stable region, or does it set up a conflict?
Well, I tend to agree with the caller that the best way to lead economically is by good example, and agricultural subsidies are the perfect example of where the United States is not leading by good example.
Elizabeth Economy, I know we have to lose you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Elizabeth Economy joined us from New York. She's Senior Fellow for China and Director of Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're talking tonight about President Bush in Asia and America's changing role there as China steps up, about Washington pushing security while Beijing is all charm and business. You can join the conversation. Can the U.S. be all about security and still be appealing in Asia? And does President Bush sound like a prophet of growth and prosperity or a prophet of fear and doom with the security agenda? Does he have a choice in an age of terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush in Asia and America's changing role there as China steps up. The president will be leaving shortly from Singapore, if he's not in the air already on Air Force One, and headed to Bali in Indonesia, then to Australia, completing a six-nation whirlwind tour of Asia. You can join the conversation tonight. Can Washington share the stage with an ascendant Beijing and still call the shots in Asia? And does security always come first, or is there an economic imperative being slighted here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio tonight by Robert Ross, professor of political science at Boston College. David's calling right now from Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I have a scenario. I mean, just a question as a scenario. What happened if Far East Asia and Southeast Asia decided to trade with each other and replace Europe with the United States? I mean, then what do you think they're going to do with their power?
But why would they do that, David? America's a luscious market that's made them rich. Why would they walk away from it?
No, I mean, I just want to see the professor what's his answer, you know, this question, because it's just scenario. I'm just wondering.
Well, it raises this interesting question. Can there really be light between the United States and Asia? These economies are so dependent on the American market. Is there an option to a huge, long-term interaction with the United States?
For many years, we've spoken of an East Asian economic zone, and it was always something that just couldn't be done because the trade across the Pacific was simply too great. And there was no intra-regional trade of sufficient critical mass that they could leave us out.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening slowly, but I think with determinedly, is that China is becoming to the region what the United States is to NAFTA, that anchor, that market in which we can create a free trade zone based upon the U.S. market. China is building those free trade zones and making it possible to have an East Asian free trade zone in which the United States will be less important than it is today.
So when Asia then looks at Washington and they feel that change, and you can see it, you can hear it in the comments of people this week, what do they think about the U.S. agenda around security? Does this look like a legitimate and important concern of Washington's that they feel they voluntarily want to get in harness with, or does it look like an obsession in Washington that's warping a view of the world?
I think each country in the region is going to evaluate terrorism individually. How big a danger does it pose to its own country, and will step up accordingly? The Philippines has real problems, and therefore they're our most cooperative partner in the region. Singapore has less of an issue. It's going to be very hard for us to coerce other countries to line up. Having said that, on their own, none of these countries want terrorists operating in their borders, and all of these countries have, to one degree or another, a ruthless police state, which can handle terrorism quite well. So at one level, we're getting lip service from these countries. We're not going to line up behind the United States. On the other hand, none of them are going to tolerate terrorism in their borders in any case.
So is there a cost to the U.S., to economic activity in the region, when this week George Bush comes with a largely security-oriented agenda? Does that keep trade walls up? Does that make the road back to Cancun and trade liberalization more difficult? Is there a cost that these countries feel, or does trade just go on in spite of that?
I think you're right. Trade goes on in spite of that. There was simply no way the American president could walk into a multinational Asian conference of the major powers in the region and not talk about what's most on American minds, security and terrorism.
Kailash is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Kailash. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good.
Great show.
Thanks.
I just am curious about the whole premise of the show, the age of terrorism. If you ask me, we've seen terrorism in one form or the other for many decades. It's not until we actually got hit that it became an age of terrorism from our perspective. I think it's important for us to recognize that terrorism exists in one form or the other everywhere in the world. And the fact that we became so badly the victim of it has really, it's percolated up to our attention. So I think our perspective should be tempered by that. I mean, that this is a global problem that exists, and it's not unique to us.
Kailash, your phone's breaking up on us, but let us pick up on the nub of that, and the we and the our here becomes very important. I mean, it is the United States, and it is that image of the World Trade Center towers going down. It was pretty spectacular by any historical standard, I would say, but it raises a legitimate question. In Asia's eyes, Robert Ross, when they think about security, how high does terrorism as a security issue rank?
Well, the bombing in Bali, Indonesia, put terrorism high on the agenda of Southeast Asia. They were willing to look the other way if it was America's problem. That was a wake-up call.
And large Muslim populations in Indonesia, of course, in Malaysia, in Singapore, neighboring lots of countries.
Absolutely. And the tourist economy collapsed in Indonesia following that bombing. Economy had an impact. So on the one hand, the caller is right. For many years, this was a global problem, but it wasn't America's problem. naturally, when it comes to us, we redefine our interests, and now it's our problem, and we're going to try and use our power to bring other countries into line with us. Having said that, to the extent that other countries had already experienced terrorism, they're more than happy that America was now willing to cooperate with them.
Mm-hmm. And focusing on it and maybe not being quite as critical of those the police state kind of apparatus that you mentioned
fair
earlier.
Point. Fair point. A country like China felt it was battling terrorism for many years and couldn't arouse any sympathy from the United States. But now that we want Chinese cooperation, their terrorism and counterterrorism looks just like that rather than human rights violations.
Deepankar is calling from Appleton, Wisconsin. Hi, Deepankar. You're on the air. Hello, Deepankar. Are you there?
Yes, I'm there. Okay, a question, Tom. Enjoying the show. Question for your guest.
Yes.
10 years from now, how do you see Washington leveraging the role of India vis-a-vis China in this equation? Would like to hear that. Thanks.
Oh, it's a great question. Thanks for your call. Here's another booming economy, enormous country. How does that change the equation as India comes more and more on stream?
Very good question. First of all, in the last 3 or 4 years, we've seen greater Indian-U.S. strategic cooperation than we've seen throughout the entire Cold War. And the implicit target is China. We both have concerns, and this makes it easier to cooperate. Whether India becomes a major power that enables us to leverage against China, that I have doubts, simply because of the geopolitical reality of the region. The Himalayas pose a very formidable border, so that India's challenge to China is nominal, and once again we have all that water separating India from China.
But India's got plenty of proximity to Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that they just by history and interest are not as plugged in to Southeast and East Asia? Mm-hmm. They'll stay on their side of the mountains and it doesn't really make a balancing wheel to China?
I hate to sound like a broken record, but it's water, water, and water. And even in the age of missiles and aircraft and space launches, you need to be able to cross water to have an impact on other nations. Indian Ocean is very large, and those Southeast Asian countries are still very far away.
And what about China and a navy? What's keeping it from developing a navy? Does it feel once it develops a navy, it can no longer avoid the Taiwan question, and then it puts it straight in the teeth of Washington? Or why? I know that they're historically, they shied away from a navy for a long, long time, but they're a superpower now. They're in space now, manned in space. Mm-hmm. When? A navy for China?
Very good question. I think two issues. One that you hit on. They would be in America's face. And it wouldn't take long for the United States to see that development in the Chinese Navy and quickly decide we have to do more. I think the Chinese understand that's not a race they want.
More like what? You mean more U.S. Naval vessels?
Absolutely.
In East Asia?
Our budget would go up, our presence would go up, neutralizing whatever China would try and do. That's not a race they want.
Boy, but their Navy would be a lot closer to home and much cheaper, I would think, to maintain in those waters. They just don't need it, you're saying.
I'm saying they'd like it. But the second problem is also important. They have such a long land border that to divert resources from developing land border security mm-hmm. would be very difficult. We have the luxury of having Mexico and Canada on our borders. If mm-hmm. we want to develop that navy at the expense of a land force, we go ahead and do it.
Whereas their neighbors across the water are fairly friendly. They're trading partners and markets. They're not threats, by and large.
There's that, except for the United States Navy that's on their borders. But in some respects, China and Japan both will remain dependent on the U.S. Navy for access to the region. That's the long-term reality.
Dependent on the U.S. Navy, that is, to be the cop on the beat who keeps those trade lanes open.
Absolutely. They may not like having to depend on us. It's never comfortable to have to do that. But for the foreseeable future, they have no choice.
John's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes, I would think that China's smaller neighbors would have a great fear of China, seeing as there is Chinese history and proclivity to push out populations as they expand. I think this is scared neighbors. What I'm talking about specifically in Western China, they've moved in tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Han Chinese to push out the Uyghurs, who they aren't particularly loyal to Beijing. We've seen the same thing in Tibet, where they're pushing out the Tibetans. There's more Chinese in Tibet than there are Tibetans now. And I would think their neighbors, as China grows, and it will grow, would be a great fear
With that enormous population sitting there, let us take it up. And, John, thanks for your call. Fair enough. In the West and in Tibet, Robert Ross, on the other hand, you don't see Chinese surging into Vietnam or into Korea, over the mountains and into Burma. That's not happening as far as I know.
First, the caller's right. If any case, he may underestimate the number of Chinese millions going into Xinjiang, going into Tibet. We do see Chinese traders moving into Mongolia and moving into Burma and moving into Thailand. And many of them will say they're coming, they're going to marry our women, and they will go our race. That is a fear. The question is how countries respond to fears. They can either look for countries to help them. In this case, it might be the United States. Or if they feel that we're not available or that our presence is not strong enough, then they do what they must and they accommodate. And that's often what we're seeing take place with China today.
But is that really happening in significant numbers outside of Tibet, outside of Xinjiang? Do you really have influxes of Chinese into Burma and Thailand that are demographically significant?
Just not the migration issue. You're right. We shouldn't overplay that. But if you're a country like Vietnam or Laos or Burma, you see your common border with 1.3 billion Chinese, that's power. And so the question is, now that they're growing, how do you deal with it? And there is that fear.
What about a country across the water but tremendously important economically, Japan? Its economy has been down for the last decade, but it's still enormous. How does it look at this emerging, inevitable kind of regional contest between the United States and China?
On the one hand, we can look at Japan and say it's still the second largest economy in the world. Absolutely true. But we don't tend to evaluate political power in terms of the absolute size of its GDP. We tend to ask, to what extent do other countries need it? And Japan shot itself in the foot for 50 years of protectionism so that it never developed. Other countries depended on it.
So it's not a market that anybody needs.
Absolutely. And so that China, because of its need for other people's goods, opens itself up. And so the Japanese economy, although large, is not a major player in the political realm in Southeast Asia. It remains in that regard depending on the United States for military security. And also we need to keep in mind that after 10 years of stagnation and 20 years of Japanese growth, there's a bit of trading places taking place.
But as they look out then, knowing their own political weakness, seeing this power shift, whatever its dimensions, between the United States and China, how does Japan observe that? Do they welcome it? Is it just a fact of life? Do they fear it?
I think what we'll see happen is Japan will look at the U.S. Navy and our presence and understand that American security continue to give Japan security. On the other hand, its economic security will be divided. They'll be equally needy of both the United States and China. And so when the U.S. has expectations from Japan, Japan may look over its shoulder and ask, what does China want? Now, in the larger picture, that will not have major changes because the American military will be dominant. But it will complicate U.S.-Japan relations like never before.
Look, we've just got a minute left, Robert Ross. Look out 20, 30, 40 years. Presume that China doesn't have a catastrophic economic unraveling. Is the United States going to see a world power like it's never quite faced before in its history?
No. I think we're seeing China reach the natural limits of its expansionism. That is, we're seeing the geographical limits. It's going to expand on the Korean Peninsula gradually, but sure. It's already dominating Indochina and Thailand and Burma. And then the question is, where does it go from here? Can it reach into Asia, into the waters of Asia? And I think the answer to that, even for 30 or 40 years, is no.
With all those people, all that growth, all that economic sway?
Yes. The answer, I still feel, is no. And that's what makes the Cold War so different from the U.S.-China relationship.
So because of cultural inclinations, because of history, or because of actual geopolitical limits somehow?
Technology, money, security fears from their internal borders, becoming a naval power will just be very difficult.
How do you think President Bush did this week, Robert Ross?
He's doing fine.
All right. The world rolls on. Robert Ross, great as always to see you. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Robert Ross, professor of political science at Boston College, author of Engaging China, the Management and of an Emerging Power. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog, with help from Sarah Cook. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.